The Five Khandas. 17th of January, 1976. When I first went to Tanajan Man and listened to his Detsana, I could not understand what he said. But fortunately, I never thought of blaming him. I blame myself instead. Well, see how stupid you are, I said to myself. You have heard the Desanas of many experts and scholars in the field of Pariyatti, the Pali Canon, and you listen to the Desanas of the Somdet, a high-ranking monk. But when you listen to the Desana of Tanajan Man, an expert in the way of practice and development of the citta, you couldn't even grasp at it. Are you stupid or smart? In this way I reproach myself. For a long time Tanajan Man had been very well known and famous in the Dhamma practice of developing the citta. But when he gave a talk dealing directly with the citta, you were not able to comprehend. Now can you see with absolute clarity your own stupidity? When instructing the bhikkhus, Tanajan Man usually talked about the way of practice. I just sat there listening without understanding what he said. He could have been talking about the citta, the khandhas, or any other subject, and I would not have known the difference. Not until my citta attained to calm did I begin to understand. When the citta started to calm down, I began to catch on. Once the citta had established a samadhi base, a clearer understanding was then realized. Beyond this point, the understanding becomes increasingly profound. When he expounded the way of Panya, even though I wasn't able to tread on this path, I could feel it deeply because the citta had already begun to receive the practical Dhamma. The citta, which has a good base of samadhi, will have a good reception of Dhamma. When it is devoid of any basis, it will neither receive nor understand Dhamma. The direct way of purifying the citta is to listen regularly and practice consistently. Practicing alone by ourselves is one way of cleansing the citta. Listening to Tanajan Man's talk was another way of gradually making the citta pure. The citta would become increasingly calm and cool. During any one of his talks, if we happen to have any questions or problems, when he touched upon these points, we would understand immediately. Subsequently, we would come to understand more and more. I have read previously that a large number of the Buddhist company attained to the Magga Phala Nibbana while listening to the Dhamma elucidated by the Lord Buddha. I was neither skeptical nor convinced at the time. I wasn't interested. I gave no thought to the matter. It was not until I actually took up the practice that I began to understand. The attainments of those who receive the instruction are of various levels. When the citta listens to a desana on one occasion, its understanding will proceed up to a certain level. Then it will have more questions on some other points. When the teacher gives another desana, the citta will then pass beyond these points, gain more understanding, and move on up to the next level. Eventually, it will transcend all of them. especially those who have reached the subtle levels of Dhamma, will advance very rapidly. This refers to practitioners, or more specifically, the Bhikkhu company. To them, the practice of Samadhi, Bhavana, is of paramount importance, because they are doing it regularly. The amount of development of each citta varies, and it depends on the practice of each individual. Listening to desanas is one way of clearing the path, by which each practitioner can steadily forge ahead, little by little. Those who have the potential to pass beyond any level will move on accordingly. Realizing the Magga Phala Nibbana refers to the citta's continual progress through the various attainment levels which result from listening to the Dhamma of a teacher and applying it in practice. When he gives a desana that clears up our doubts, we will then pass beyond and transcend them once and for all. Consider the case of the Venerable Anyatara Bhikkhu. He had a question concerning the subtle level of Dhamma. He went to the Lord Buddha to make an inquiry. As he reached the lower level of the Lord's cottage, it began to rain. So he stood there and watched the rain as it dripped off the roof and splashed into water on the ground, creating bubbles which then broke up and disappeared. He then contemplated and compared it with the internal process, namely sankhara, thinking and imagining. At the level he had attained, the citta is more interested in investigating sanya and sankhara, the conceiving and perceiving of the heart, than all the other things. When the rain fell into the water, it produced ripples and also bubbles, which subsequently disappeared. He investigated and compared it to the process occurring inside himself, the conceiving of the citta, the thinking of good and evil, which successively rise and cease. When the bubbles broke up, they returned to water. When sankhara completed its thinking and conceiving, it returned to the citta. As a result, he attained to the highest level of Dhamma, right there in that very place. As soon as he did, the rain stopped, and so he went back to his own cottage and did not go to the Lord Buddha to make his inquiry, because he no longer had any questions to ask. There. When a true Dhamma enters the citta, it is immediately rid of doubt. Even though he intended to question the Lord, he would not have done so, because he no longer had any doubts. Though he might inquire, the Lord would have given the reply that he had already comprehended. Thus, there was no longer any problem, and so he returned to his cottage. Once a practitioner advances to the Panya level, then wherever he is, he listens to Dhamma all the time. Whatever things come into contact, he investigates them all as Dhamma. All these contacted objects will arouse sati, mindfulness. Panya will then automatically follow right behind, investigating swiftly and without having to be prompted, as it had to be in the early stages when it was like a pig, which refuses to get off the chopping block until it is chopped into pieces. The citta of this level is well aware of the nature of the contacted objects. It investigates everything in the light of Dhamma. just as in the case of Tanajan Man's reply to the Mahathera, which I have recorded in Tanajan Man's biography. The Mahathera asked, "When you are living alone and happen to have some questions, who do you consult or confer with?" Tanajan Man replied, "I listen to Desanas continually, both day and night." The Mahathera did not dare to challenge his words. Perhaps he did not understand. Perhaps it was the truth of what Tanajan Man said. In any case, he did not dare to dispute with him. Listening to Desanas day and night refers to the perpetual investigation of the contacted object, satipanya continually on the alert, and resulting in understanding gained level by level. This is the practical way of listening to Dhamma both day and night. Satipanya of this level is automatic, working entirely for Dhamma, and completely devoid of worldly affairs. This is why the Lord taught us to develop calm for the citta. Once we have established calm for from the samadhi practice, we should then investigate with panya. Panya will concentrate on doing its work, and the citta will be free from hunger, anxiety, and restlessness. The tranquil citta, firmly grounded on calm within the heart, will be efficient in doing its contemplation and analysis, as it is free from hunger and not preoccupied with the various kinds of mental emotional objects antagonistic to the heart. Panya will perform in earnest. It will really investigate, proceeding in harmony with our intention and not dilly-dallying here and there. The Lord therefore declared, "Samadhi paripavita panya maha pala hoti mahani sangsa." Wisdom well developed by samadhi produces great results and great benefits. It is quick and efficient, swift and brilliant in its investigation, much more so than the citta, without the basis of calm. Samadhi and panya are therefore inseparable. The practitioner will regularly make use of them at their appropriate time. Even the enlightened ones must use samadhi as the abode of rest and relaxation as long as they are still in possession of the khandhas. Because samadhi is perfect device for keeping the khandhas and the citta happy and in harmony. As long as the citta is doing a lot of thinking and overtaxing itself with work, then of course it will become tired. Now it must completely let go of the internal work of thinking and conceiving, and take a rest by remaining in the solitary calm of samadhi, without concern for any khandhas. After withdrawing from this state, the citta will be strengthened. Both the khandhas and the citta will be on an even keel, and they will be able to keep on working. The arahants have to treat the khandhas in this way until the day of their final passing away. Samadhi must always be used in this manner. That is why it is said that they exert themselves, an effort applied between the citta and the khandhas, solely for the sake of living comfortably and not for removing any kilesas. If the citta and khandhas are treated improperly, the khandhas will suffer damage and not last as long as they should. But the pure citta is neither damaged nor affected in any way. It is just that the dhatu khanda will not endure to its natural end. Therefore, treat the khandhas and the citta properly. This is known as ditta dhamma, vihara dhamma, the dhamma which promotes easy living for as long as the citta still possesses the khandhas. What fosters the strength of the khandhas? Diligent effort and calm. They keep the khandhas healthy and normal until their natural end. What assists the kilesa-dominated citta and frees it step by step? Satipanya is the agent that assists, cleanses, and overcomes all the different kinds of obstacles. This is similar to going on a journey. When we happen to run into barriers of barbs and thorns, we clear the path by cutting them with a knife. Then we continue trekking, cutting away any obstacles along the way as we keep moving ahead. The citta can easily and safely advance if it is protected by satipanya, which continually helps make the necessary correction. It keeps the citta moving on, advancing and attaining to freedom right within the heart. The practice of developing the citta is to use satipanya to observe the citta's activity in going out to the various kinds of mental emotional objects. This is vital for the practitioner. It is the exclusive way of learning and knowing about ourselves. In learning about the citta's nature, we have to know about its every encounter and about the objects coming into contact with it. Whatever the direction and whatever kinds of mental emotional objects to which the citta might apply its stream of knowing, satipanya must always consciously follow behind, taking care of the citta, setting it right, and not allowing it to think and imagine on its own. Once we have develop strong satipanya, then the instant the citta stirs itself up, it will simultaneously arouse satipanya to become aware of its thoughts and imaginings. Swiftly and promptly, panya will follow through with its investigation. Once having understood them, it will let go of them. The citta's affairs are not one, but many. It thinks about this and imagines about that. Infinite in number are the citta's affairs. All are the tricks and gimmicks of the kilesas. Samudaya induces the citta to think and imagine. Thus, satipanya must continually follow behind and investigate. Eventually, the citta will get to understand, due to this pursuit and systematic examination with sound and logical deduction. Once the heart has acquired the correct reasoning, the citta will release its objects. It won't cling to it anxiously. It will steadily abandon them all. This is how to use satipanya to let go of upadana, clinging to the khandhas and the citta. Samadhi by itself can only provide calm for the heart. Nothing is relinquished yet. This temporary calm serves as a basis or foundation for joy and peace. Devoid of restlessness and dissatisfaction, common to the untrained, ordinary citta. Satipanya, however, is the instrument which digs, searches, cuts, and slashes at the entanglements within the citta. This is entirely the business of panya, which is irreplaceable in the work of overcoming the kilesas. Citta bhavana, or mind development, is usually fraught with difficulties at first. In sitting practice, we tire easily due to few results. The citta is hard to tame, unyielding, and resists us fiercely. Sometimes we cannot even withstand it. In the early stages, we usually lose out to it. But by relying on our persistent training and discipline, we may one day enter into calm. Thus making the goal of tranquility a reality. This will serve as the heart's testimony and encouragement to arouse new energy and further our development. Beyond that, we will experience more and more calm. Once the heart is tranquil, it is also cool and relaxed, as if it had an anchor to secure it. If it has no calm, we will not know where our foothold is. It is like drifting at sea in a boat, under a heavy storm, with no idea of what to take for anchor or mooring. The heart will be afflicted with severe loneliness, agitation, and anxiety, because it now has no means of support. Calm is therefore an excellent support for the heart. In the early stage of mind development, the Lord recommended the development of calm for the heart. The Dhamma themes for directing the citta must not be considered high or low by the meditator. The correct theme is whatever suits one's character. When the citta is inclined to go out repeatedly, we should then recall our meditation subject more rapidly. Sati must be up with it. Then the citta won't get a chance to sneak away, and it will slip into calm. The heart is then tranquil, cool, relaxed, and possessed with a basis. When we look around, we will no longer be burnt with rage and furiously angered, as before. Leaving the calm state, we then investigate with panya, contemplating and examining the body, which is anicchang, dukkhang, and anatta. The calm in the heart will become increasingly more profound, and panya will become more skillful and discerning. The conduct to be investigated with panya can be either the internal or external conducts. we can examine any one of them, because each is full of anicjang, dukkhang, and anatta. This is the analysis and differentiation for the purpose of seeing their true nature. The result is that the heart can be rid of its anxiety. Finally, we will come around to investigate our own khandhas. I have continually stressed that unless we investigate the khandhas, all five of them, we cannot let go of them, for they are the vital principle of the Sacca Dhamma, truthful Dhamma, essential to the citta's progress and Panya's knowledge. They are Panya's indispensable grindstone. If Satipanya is no match for them, then they can be extremely antagonistic to us. This is why we must investigate the khandhas through and through, from many different angles. The khandhas, which are always attached to us, continually show their abnormality, unsatisfactoriness, dukkha, and their agony and troubles. All forms of suffering are rooted in the khandhas and the citta. Whatever pierces the khandhas also stabs at the heart, perpetually afflicting it with dukkha and unrest. Thus, we must apply Satipanya in such a way that catches on to these developments. In truth, the khandhas have no intention to incite this disturbance. It is just the citta's own doing, which has false perception of them. When dukkha appears, it is quite natural, quite normal. It is similar to the sun's radiation when it strikes the body and produces a hot sensation, even though it does not know the meaning of itself. Water is the same. It doesn't know that it is cold. Both sun and fire don't know that they are hot. The one who knows is us, who are in contact with the water, sun, and fire. The occurring dukkha vedana, painful feeling, doesn't know that it is vedana or dukkha, nor does it know that it is sukha, pleasant. It is just a natural process. But when there is contact between the citta and these things, the result is the arising of sukha or dukkha and the forming of a set of meanings which can induce the dukkha in the heart. These meanings are critical because they can turn into kilesas and increase dukkha. In fact, they are directly the work of the kilesas. According to the truth of this natural process, namely dukkha vedana of the body, it is quite natural for it to be experienced by everybody. even the Lord Buddha himself was not exempted from experiencing dukkha vedana in his body. The Arahants also acknowledge this body vedana. For them, however, it was quite natural, quite normal, because they had fully comprehended the natural course of things. They knew that the dukkha vedana occurring in the body is one form of natural process, similar to all other natural processes. This process, however, interacts with the citta. Consequently, the citta, by virtue of its true nature, merely acknowledges the reality of this process. In this case, dukkha vedana. Thus, nothing can generate further dukkha in the citta of the enlightened ones, because they are not deluded. When it appears, they knew that this is merely an occurring phenomenon. They knew when it occurs and when it disappears. They knew all the three phases: rising, occurring, and disappearing. These recurring phases are inherent in the khandhas, as in the example of dukkha vedana. This is how the khandhas evolve: appearing, remaining, and disappearing. It is the same with vijnana, the one which acknowledges. But the khanda which affects us most is dukkha vedana. The Lord therefore exhorted us to investigate it so as to see it according to its true nature, because this dukkha vedana is an absolute truth. If the citta could investigate the dukkha vedana and see it as it actually is, the citta itself will be true. It won't burden itself by clinging to it, but will be set free from it. They each are true and exist independently. Even during the final moments, when we are about to break up, it will happen in the same manner. As dukkha vedana ceases, the khandhas will all dissolve. These five khandhas will all pass away at the same time. That which doesn't pass on is the one and only nature that knows, which is none other than the citta, the one who knows. This one remains unchanged. The conditions or functions of the citta change, but the citta itself is immutable. To investigate and compare is to truly come to understand the khandhas. The Lord described them in unalterable terms. If we didn't go against the truth of his teaching, then we wouldn't have to experience dukkha. The Lord had already exhorted that. Rupang anicchang, rupang anatta, vedana anatta, sanya anatta, sankhara anatta, vijnanang anatta. Body is impermanent. Body is not self. Feeling is not self. Perception is not self. Thought is not self. Sense awareness is not self. There, how could they be self? Anatta, anatta. The Lord clearly revealed this. He had shut the door to prevent us from clinging and grasping at them, and having false views about them. Because whether they are anatta or atta, self, doesn't make any difference to them. However, they can be harmful to us, who are deluded. In the final analysis, it is precisely this delusion which is harmful to us. That is why we are being taught to analyze and examine these things. Next, we turn the citta around to take a look at the citta itself, to see its own misperception and the delusion of clinging to these things. Then it must correct all the internal errors, so as to get rid of all the doubts concerning the external objects, as well as the doubts about itself, and to come to see the faults of its own delusion. This correcting process is twofold, internal and external. The five khandhas were described by the Lord as anicchaṁ, dukkhaṁ, anattā. They are really one and are inseparable. The unity of dukkhaṁ, anicchaṁ, and anattā is like the sides of the same person, back, front, left, and right. This is the left side. This is the right side. This is the back, and this is the front side. But it is still the same person. Anicchaṁ, dukkhaṁ, and anattā are different aspects of the self-same khandhas. To elaborately differentiate them would be more confusing than useful. If we find that we have the knack for any particular aspect, like the investigation of dukkhaṁ, then we go ahead with this investigation because it will spread on to the aspects of anicchaṁ and anattā. This is true for any aspect. When we investigate into anattā, it will involve the other two. Likewise with anicchaṁ. The point here is to use the one that the investigator has a flair for. It is essential that we have a feel for them, because this will enable us to see their true nature. We must not run contrary to the Lord Buddha's truth. He said that these are the tilakkhana, characteristics of all phenomena, and that we should not grasp or cling to them, and not carry or shoulder them, because they are heavy. Our hearts will then steadily shed our burden and dukkha. Dukkhang, anicchang, and anatta are inherent in every khanda. Rupa is a group of the tilakkhana. Vedana is also tilakkhana. So is sanya, sankhara, and vijnana. They are absolutely true to their nature. If we don't cling to them, don't make false assumptions about them, and don't claim them as I and mine, then we will experience bliss. This is how we should investigate with panya. The citta should be circumspectly wise with itself, because if it is lacking in wisdom, it will deludedly fall for them. We can't rightly blame them for our delusion. We are deluded, and we should therefore blame ourselves. When we come to know, then there is no reason for blame. All of these conditions or processes have been there from our day of birth until our dissolution. No one can take them along because they belong to nature. Let go of the groups of body, feelings, perceptions, thoughts, and sense awareness. Let them be as they really are. Investigate them so as to understand them from now on. Then we will be free of care. This is one level of investigation. The ultimate level of dukkha, samudaya, and dhamma is on the level of the citta itself. What is this citta level? The citta here refers to the mergence of the citta with avicca, ignorance, and is incredibly brilliant, magnificent, and sublime. It is totally detached from all of the above mentioned processes. This level of knowing has completely let go of both rupa and nama, name and form. This knowing is most outstanding, most incredibly wonderful, to the point where it induces its owner to become deludedly captivated by it. This owner highly cherishes and treasures it, and considers it the most precious thing. It is most eminent and super excellent, surpassing all the things previously encountered, experienced, and investigated by this owner. Nothing is as magnificent, exalted, luminous, brilliant, or spectacular as this particular citta. The Lord said this is the nature of the genuine avicca citta, which can certainly cause us to become deluded. If the practitioner is not forewarned, he will inevitably become deluded at this point. Therefore, when we know the distinguished features of this point, no avicca is like this. Our investigation now focuses exclusively on the citta itself, because everything else has been understood. As soon as Sankhara arises, it will cease and return to avicca, because avicca is the one who gives the command. As long as avicca remains, the conceiving of sankhara will be directed by avicca. Whatever we acknowledge, that acknowledging will always be the manipulation of avicca. All our perceiving and imaginings are the works of the kilesas, because they are all directed by avicca. Therefore, we must probe into the avicca citta, the ignorant heart, and take the avicca citta as the object or target of investigation. We aim satipanya, mindfulness and wisdom at this point, by not taking this knowing as self. If we still take this knowing as self, our investigation will be hampered by the apprehension that this knowing will deteriorate or dissolve, disappear or be obliterated. We won't want to touch it, and this would be precisely a form of kilesa, completely deceiving us. To really follow the correct form of investigation, we must take this point where the knowing is most vivid and spectacular as the point of investigation. Unravel at this point. Examine at this point. Just like we did with all the other processes. Don't take this thing as high and that one as low, as I or as mine. Not even the citta or the knowing should be seen as I or mine. To understand the citta, we must investigate at this point. How then could we not understand? How could it withstand the proof? We will understand when satipanya gets to the avicca citta and unravels by way of investigation. The one which was so wondrously spectacular will dissolve away. This last master of deception is clearly visible to us as this particular nature. Questions about the citta, khandhas, and all the natural processes are now settled. When the citta has eliminated its inner problems, then nothing in the world can be a problem. This is the culmination of Dhamma investigation and Dhamma practice. To know dukkha and dukkha's cause, samudaya, is to know this final point. From there on, there is nothing more to know. So what then can we be deluded with? It's just not possible. From here on, the citta is no longer under the sway of samuti, the conventional way of the world, either good or evil. The Lord said, Usitang brahmachariyang katang karaniyang na pachang itatayati pachanati. Lived out is the holy life. Complete is the task that must be done. There is no further work to do, because we have comprehended all things. Buddhist practice is not all that complicated when seen from this Dhamma viewpoint. But before getting to this point, it was a life and death struggle for each practitioner. The last stage here is similar to the rice in the plate. The rice looks simple enough. The only thing to do is to eat it. But look at how the rice came to be here. Try to trace it yourself. Then, oh, it does nothing but infuriate your heart to the extent that you wouldn't even want to eat it. This rice came from the field and so much else. Before harvesting and cooking, you have to go through a lot of dukkha and hardship, endure the weather, sun and rain, and bearing up under all kinds of travail. Furthermore, it took a whole season before you could reap the harvest, and finally eat the rice. My Dhamma investigation also proceeded in fits and starts. I really strained myself in disciplining and training the citta with Dhamma. I forced the citta to recollect Buddho, Dhammo, and Sangho, and I failed time and time again. Many hundreds and thousands of times I failed. My failures were countless, but I kept on struggling and striving with effort and perseverance until arriving at this point where it is most appropriate for me to let go of my heart, all my burdens, and become totally free of worries. The work in the initial stage is very involved, incredibly heavy. So heavy that I could hardly shoulder it. Most of the time I couldn't bear it. Only some of the time I could. At present, if I have to describe this work, I would have to say that it was so involved and far-reaching, to the extent where I couldn't see the path. Once this work narrowed in, becoming less complicated, then it was just like what I had elaborated. When the work on this less involved level is completed, it is no longer possible to say that it is very involved or less complicated. It is inexplicable, because that's all there is to it. The citta is now liberated. Nothing can be said further. This is the realm totally free of dukkha. The Lord Buddha and the Savakas attained this realm. Neither the Lord Buddha nor the Savakas is purer than the other. All are equal. Any distinction is in individual ability, wisdom, and knowledge of Dhamma. Although a Buddha's talent is more profound than the other Savakas, the purity is all the same. The Lord said, Nati seyo japatiyo. All the pure ones are no more or less pure than the others. All the enlightened ones, the arahants, from the Lord Buddha on down, are equally pure. In his nimitta, Tanajanman was shown how all the noble ones paid respects to each other during the Buddha's time. The nimitta reveal the seating arrangements when the Savaka Sangha and the Lord Buddha assembled together. Whoever arrived first sat in the front. When the Lord Buddha arrived last, he sat at the back. Seniority was not the criterion here. Tanajan Mun became anxiously intrigued as to why it was like this. Was this how they showed respect in the Buddha's time? He immediately recognized this was the Visuddhi Dhamma, the pure Dhamma, in which they were all equal. First come, first sit basis. Equality, irrespective of seniority, because all were equally pure. Tanajan Mun then wondered how they would show respect according to Sammuti convention. In a flash, the Nimitta was rearranged, with the Lord Buddha sitting in the front, and the Savakas in descending order of seniority. Seniority was the basis for showing respect in conditions of Sammuti. Tanajan Mun was clearly shown the methods in Vimutti and Sammuti. When showing respect, nobody does it more gracefully than those rid of the Gilesas. In their case, there was no call for ceremony or putting on a front, as between people with Kilesas. They truly respected one another, respected their Dhamma attainments, and respected the truth. They are able to confidently show respect because they respect truth with the truth in their hearts. Ordinary people like us have pleasant manners, but the pleasantness is cosmetic, not real, or originating from the real, from the genuine Dhamma. The inside is stiff and doesn't conform to the external show, which is gentle and polite. Thus, the world is uneven and irregular, unlike the truth which springs from the genuine truth. Today, I will only say this much. I now conclude this talk.